just to kind of recap and do a little intro of where we are and kind of where we're going, we've been looking at the three transcendentals of Christianity. That's what truth, goodness, and beauty are. And the whole reason we're doing this class is because I believe that these three things help bolster the Christian worldview, okay? In fact, I would say that truth, goodness, and beauty are necessary pillars to having a healthy worldview. Christianity, I believe, and we believe, best explains where truth comes from, where goodness comes from, and where beauty comes from. So that's why we're doing this class. And if you remember, early on in the class, we observed that Christianity and these three transcendentals have been relegated over time and divided kind of into two stories. So in the lower story, you have what's rational, what's objective, what is knowable. This is where society placed physics, mathematics, biology, at one time, even religion and God was placed in this lower story as something that was assumed as true, assumed as objective, and assumed as knowable. Okay? That's where Christianity, truth, goodness, and beauty once lived. But as time has gone on and as we've traced throughout the history of truth, the history of this class, Christianity, the Bible, truth, goodness, beauty has slowly moved into this upper story. The upper story is the non-rational, the subjective, the preferential, the aesthetic, the taste. So this is where politics is. This is where the realm of ethics is, kind of these gray areas of the moral life. This is where ice cream is. You have your preferences and you have your tastes and I have mine. And over time, we have begun to see truth this way. We've begun to see goodness this way. We've begun to see beauty this way. That it's not something objective and knowable. Instead, it's something subjective and preferential. Does this make sense? We've traced this over the course of this entire class. So, like with truth, for example, and with goodness, we've I think proven quite well that truth and goodness or morality, when Austin taught on that subject, are objective, right? I think that we're on pretty safe ground to say that truth is absolute and objective, and morality is also objective. Meaning that there are things that are objectively true, and there are things that are objectively not true. Just as there are things that are objectively good, and there's objectively things that are not good. So if you remember, with truth, for example, we can look at the external world, we can look at the reality of things like mathematics, of our famous 2 + 2 = 4, and say that this is an eternal and timeless truth, and therefore there must be an eternal timeless God that brings forth that truth, right? So that's what we said with the subject of truth. But now we're approaching the subject of beauty, okay? What about beauty? If there's any one of the three transcendentals that maybe should be relegated to the upper story, surely it's beauty, right? Because after all, what is beauty? What does society tell us that beauty is? Beauty is
in the eye of the beholder.
In the eye of the beholder, right? What does that mean? What does it mean that beauty is in the eye of the beholder? What do you think? we all see it different ways. It means that beauty ultimately is self-determined because we are the beholders, right? We behold beauty, and therefore our perception of beauty is going to be different, perhaps, than someone else's perception of beauty, right? So problem solved, I guess. It should just be up here and we can go home. Not quite. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. That's very interesting. I guess we should ask, is it really in the eye of the beholder? What if the beholder's eye is distorted? And how do our experiences inform what real beauty is and what real beauty isn't? But let me just start off kind of at the beginning saying that in some sense, beauty is subjective. It is, right? Why can we say this? Human beings were all made in the image of God, right? Every one of us made in the image of God. True or false?
True.
But here's the thing. We all don't look the same. Like every single human being looks a little bit different, right? Even identical twins have certain characteristics and certain features that deem them different from one another. So physically, we all look different from one another, and yet we all bear the image of God. We also have distinct voices, right? We all have different kinds of voices. Some of us have angelic voices, like Adele or Taylor Swift. I don't know.
Phil Wickham.
Phil Wickham has a very angelic voice. But we all have different voices, and we can use those voices to make different sounds. We also have our own brains, right? Each of us has our own particular brain that God has given us. With our brains, we think, we calculate, we create, we emote, we store memories, we dream, we imagine things. This is all given to us by God. But every brain has its own set of DNA strand that it operates out of, which means that our brains are distinct from one another. So what am I getting at here? Inevitably, we all have different brains, which means we're all going to have different tastes and different preferences and different likes and dislikes. We're going to have pet peeves, and we're going to have strengths, and we're going to have weaknesses, okay? We're going to have talents, etc. So here's what I'm getting at. With this much variation in God's created world, there is beauty to be found in it. And so our own experiences of beauty, whether we're talking about physical beauty, like a beautiful landscape, a beautiful sunset going down below the horizon, whether we're talking about satisfactory beauty, meaning we feel a sense of satisfaction and wholeness, perhaps from our work or from our families, or we're talking about artistic beauty. We see things that other people have done and created. Whatever we're talking about it, whatever beauty we're talking about it, these things are inherently good. And so what I'm getting at is that beauty is subjective, and that's okay. That's a good thing, that beauty is subjective. Now, it's not all of what beauty is, but I think that we can acknowledge straight away that God's world has a lot of variety to it. God, when God created the world, he created not just one kind of plant in the plant kingdom or one kind of animal, but thousands and thousands and thousands of variations of those plants and vegetations and animals. So there's variation in God's creation, and that's made to reflect the beauties of God. So we have categories within subcategories. So he didn't just make mountains, he made hills. And he didn't just make oceans, he made rivers. And he makes crops and plants and food. He's given us the ability to create beauty ourselves. And this is something that we're going to go into for our last session. But like we have all kinds of ways that we can create beauty. We can play music. We can design sculptures and paint art. He's given us the ability to write poetry and prose, to perform theatrically, to dance. Even sports and athletics contain their own kind of beauty. We've all seen what grown men and women can do with a ball, right? It's pretty incredible, whether we're talking about basketball or football or volleyball or baseball, these kinds of things that we can do athletically with the rules of a game. So yes, beauty is going to be subjective. And so here's my question then. If we recognize that that beauty is subjective based on the way that God created us, can beauty ever be objective? What do you think? Cody's saying yes. What do you guys think? Do you think it's safe, yes, to,
yeah,
fair
think,
to say?
I think there's some types of beauty that are objective.
Okay.
Or at least more objective in nature than subjective.
Yeah.
Is objective and universal the same?
I would say so. I'd say the universal beauty would be related to some sort of objective beauty. What do you think, Chris?
I can't think of a specific, but I feel like yes, probably is.
I think sacrifice for something is a pretty objective nature of beauty. I think most people can see. It's a pretty universal, like, okay, this person laid down, like, you know, thinking of a more modern story, like Desmond Doss and like Hacksaw Ridge, right? How he didn't kill anybody, but like risked his life over and over again to save soldiers on both sides, right? That's a pretty like objective, universal perception of beauty. Like, okay, he was going in to save lives. Right.
Yeah.
He was constantly risking his life to do that. I'm sorry, guys. So
sorry, yeah.
It's the first time I've heard her make a noise.
Yeah. There we go. We got water now. So I think that there are some types of beauty like that that are, and I don't know if I necessarily, I don't know if I can paint a line being completely objective, but it's certainly more objective in nature than like that tree you're painting is pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Here's what I'm going to posit. I think that whether you're a Christian or non-Christian, I believe that beauty is inherently objective. And I'll see if I can prove it to you. Why do art shows have panels of judges? Why do competitions like dance competitions have judges to them if all beauty is just subjective, right? Like, why do we grade performances based on what they're doing? Why do we care about what someone like Simon Cowell has to say about how somebody sings a song? You know, Simon Cowell's not a singer himself, but yet we care about what he has to say about judging that particular piece of art. It's because what I believe is that there must be some sense of what is objectively beautiful if we're going to have the capacity to sit and judge particular forms of beauty in our world, right? If we're going to say that a rose in its beauty is much more beautiful than a like a little sticker that you step on in the yard, like there has to be some sort of way that we can measure that. There has to be some kind of standard that we can compare a sticker to a rose. And so like even take this concept of classics. Like when we call something, oh, that painting is a classic, you know, the something painted by Monet or Leonardo da Vinci, or like musical like songs, like this is a classic, you know, Johnny Cash, or who else see classics, or classical music like Bach and Mozart and Beethoven. Like, there's a reason that we call those things classics. Why do we call them classics?
Because they've been around for a while.
Yeah, they've been around for a while. They've stood the test of time. That is the standard of what makes something beautiful, is that if it can stand the test of time, if it can go beyond cultural boundaries, if it can go beyond socioeconomic statuses, and most importantly, that it testifies to something greater than itself. Like, there's a reason when we hear a piano rendition of Bach or Mozart, that people are moved to literal tears over those things. That people are moved to tears over the beauty of a sunset or the Grand Canyon or something real and tangible. It's because that thing that we're seeing as beauty actually transcends this world and carries us somewhere beyond our own five senses. So that's my posit. As I believe that beauty is subjective in the way that we experience it, but it's objective in the way that we perceive the quality of it. So if we're going to define beauty this way, here's kind of what I come up with. So let me check that box there, because we can and should say that beauty is objective. Objective beauty is the transcendental quality of an object. The transcendental quality of an object. Objective beauty. If that's objective beauty, then subjective beauty is the way in which we experience the quality of the object. It's not too complicated.
Can you repeat that second part there?
Subjective beauty is the way in which we experience the quality of the object. Subjective beauty is going to, it's our response to the object. It's how we're emotionally processing and perceiving that object. And I think that I can illustrate this biblically. Psalm 34, 4. What does that say? Psalm 34, 4. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Everyone familiar with this verse? heard this verse before? Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. You have subjective and objective beauty. Psalm 34, 4. Sorry. You have subjective and objective beauty at play in this text. Taste is what? Subjective or objective?
Subjective.
Subjective. What about seeing? Subjective or objective?
Subjective.
Subjective. Subjective. These are things we are doing. These are things that we are experiencing. That the Lord, subjective or objective?
Objective.
Objective. Is subjective or objective?
Objective.
It's is reality. taste and see spiritually, not actually taste and see, because we cannot taste God on a metaphysical, ontological level. Taste and see spiritually that the Lord is reality. Good. Good being not just objective in this sense, but good being transcendental. Does this make sense? Psalm 34:4, we taste and see, we experience the beauty of God, who is objective beauty, as good. Taste and see that the Lord is good. It's a marvelous quote. And it's part of what we, as we understand truths that are in Scripture, Plato, famous philosopher, says beauty is the splendor of truth. So these are good truths to taste and see with the mind of our eye. Okay? So here's what I want to do. I want to walk through the meta-narrative of Scripture. When we say meta-narrative, I'm talking creation, fall, redemption, restoration, and outline that the role that beauty plays in each of these. So if we start with Genesis 1, we're all familiar with it. God creates the heavens and the earth, and the Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the waters. You ever wondered what that means? Why would the author include that the Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the waters? In the ancient Near East, water was a symbol of chaos. Water was seen as something rushing and crashing and something that you could not control. It was all over the place. It could drown you. It could harm you. It was an agent of chaos. And so for the Spirit of God to hover over the waters means that what we see immediately from God is a contrast to how the rest of the ancient Near East would have understood creation narratives, okay? So, like, if you take the Babylonian tale of creation, it's this war between two different gods. It's Tiamat and Marduk. It's the sea god and the storm god. They're both fighting over one another. And the storm god ends up winning, and he when he defeats Tiamat, he splits the god in half, and he used one half of her to create the earth and the other half to create the heavens. And so immediately in this creation account, you have this battle between order and chaos, right? And a lot of the other ancient Near Eastern creative narratives display this. There's this war between order and chaos. But in Genesis, God does not bring about creation via war or via chaos. Instead, God brings about creation through his word. He speaks and things come into existence. And so you have from the very beginning, the Spirit of God hovering over the waters means that that God is in control. God is a God of order, and he's over these waters of chaos. It's not like these other creation narratives that pit some kind of chaotic war against one another. Does that make sense? And so each day of creation has a particular purpose and a particular order. So day one, what does God create day one? Haddon?
Planets?
So day one, it's before the planets get there. He creates light and darkness. Okay? So day one of creation, he's separating the light from the dark, right? So that's day one. Day two, he separates the sky from the waters, creating an expanse, right? He says, let there be an expanse between the sky and the water. So we have light, darkness, sky, water. Day three, God creates land and vegetation. He creates plant life. So he fills the earth with land on day three. And then day four parallels the first day. So day four, God fills the world with stars and the sun and the moon to rule over the light and the darkness. So there's a parallel between day one and day four. And then day five parallels day two. And so the fifth day, you have the air and the sea creatures being created. They're the fish and the birds are being filled from day two, where the sky and the waters are separated. And then the sixth day corresponds to the third day because the land is filled with its rulers, namely the animals. And so you have animals, and then you have the rulers of the animals, which is who?
Humans.
Humans. It's us. So we get created on the sixth day as well. And we've already spoken about the distinct beauty of men and women. And then the final day is God's Sabbath rest, in which his initial creative work has ended. So God, the artist, has completed his masterpiece and now is delighting in its completion. And so we see that in creation, beauty has a particular order to it. And this is going to matter later on, because a lot of our classical philosopher friends, you remember Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, those boys, they're going to understand order as integral to beauty. They're going to see like the order of things is part of like what makes up a foundational definition of beauty. They're going to see those two things in tandem with one another. So that's creation. In the fall, what happens to beauty, right?
It changes.
Yeah, it gets distorted by sin and chaos and death. And one of the effects of the fall is that there is a curse placed upon humanity, and death is brought into the world. And so our distortion of beauty blinds our mind's eye to where that we can't see. Because we can't see God fully for who he is anymore, because we don't have perfect communion and fellowship with him, we're now blinded to the beauty of God. So it's not just that we are rebellious sinners, it's that we're actually blinded to his beauty. And Paul says this much in 2 Corinthians 4. He says, "And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the god of this world, that's the devil, has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." So our minds have been blinded to beauty in the fall. I believe that Paul is using beauty imagery here. He's contrasting the blindness of our eyes with the gospel of Christ, who is the image of God. So this is fundamental to understanding how beauty was fractured. Beauty is fundamentally connected to seeing and worshiping God properly. And this is important because you think about this. Why did the Israelites and the Canaanites and the Jebusites and why did all of these ancient Near Eastern clans craft idols? Why did they make idols?
In the context of beauty.
In the context of beauty, Lord, why do we still worship idols? Why do we have idols? It's because everybody is going to worship something. We're all going to see something or someone as beautiful, whether it's true or not. Our hearts cannot help but to worship that which we perceive as beautiful. We can't help it. And so the beauty is distorted after the fall. But what's really cool is that even after the fall, God still values beauty. And we see this when we talk about the fact that in the Old Testament, where was God worshipped? Where did people come and worship God in the Old Testament? Where?
The high places,
the temple, the tabernacle. You think about it, if you read Exodus 24 to 26, there's all of these commands and regulations given for the temple, that God wants the temple and the tent to look a particular way. And it's the center of religion for the Israelites. It's not just a place where they would come and gather, but it's the place where they would go and they would say, this is where Yahweh's presence is. It's here. If we want to meet with God, we need to go into the temple and meet him in this particular place. And you think about the most precious piece of furniture inside the temple is what? In Exodus, what was the most precious piece of furniture? The Ark of the Covenant. What was in the Ark? The Ten Commandments. It was the law. It was the law given to Moses. If you look at the description of the Ark of the Covenant, it's overlaid with gold on all sides, displaying the sacred nature of the Ark. And then on top of the Ark, there was what's called the mercy seat. And this is a divine throne surrounded with two statues of heavenly beings called the cherubim. And God promised that he would be present on the throne in between these two images, right? On top of the mercy seat. And so the point that I'm getting at is that beauty still matters to God even after the fall. And so you have also in the temple, a veil was to be created, which divided the holy place in the temple from the most holy place, which was the location of the Ark of the Covenant. So you have, they call it the Holy of Holies, where you would go in and the real presence of God, the real glory of God was felt inside the temples. And so there's even we don't have time to get into this, but there's even all kinds of imagery that reflects the garden imagery inside the temple. But the point of this is to say that even in the fall, God still values beauty. And this is evidenced by the fact that he wanted his people to worship him in a particular place that looked a particular way. And he wanted to recall certain images, and he wanted them to recall, to remember what he had done for them, to remember his deliverance of them out of the land of Egypt. And so beauty still matters. So we fast forward now to redemption, right? This is the redemptive part of beauty. This is Hebrews 8, 1 through 7. Brad's going to preach on this someday. This is Hebrews 8. Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern," there's order, "that was shown to you on the mountain. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is more excellent than the old covenant, and that he mediates it. This covenant is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if the first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second." So what is the author of Hebrews saying here? He's saying that the superiority of Jesus is greater than the old covenant temple and the old covenant rites and ceremonies. Notice the language of the tabernacle being a copy and a shadow of heavenly things. In other words, all of these important things that God puts inside the temple, inside the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat and the cherubim statues, all of these things are shadows of what's really to come. That they're shadows of what true beauty is. So just like the sun casts a shadow on the earth, just the temple casts a shadow on God's glory. And so when we talk about the true beauty of God being revealed, it is revealed in what we call the incarnation. This is when the incarnation is a fancy theological term of God putting on flesh and entering into creation as the Son of God, fully God and fully man, into the earth. Jesus is what we call the revelation of God. He reveals God to us. And therefore, at his first coming, Jesus is the apex of true beauty because he reveals God. That's what's important in this redemption piece. And then, of course, you have... I don't want to skip this either. John 1:14 says, "The Word became flesh and dwelled among us." The Greek there literally reads, "The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us." He templed among us. Meaning that the arrival of the Son of God means no more temples. Because God is being revealed not in images, not in an ark, not in the law, but in a person, okay? So we don't want to miss that. And then, of course, you have beauty being redeemed in the gospel event itself. When Jesus dies on the cross in the gospels, there's lots of things that happen. But what happens in the temple when Jesus dies on the cross? The veil is torn. What does that signify?
No longer separating God's presence in the Holy of Holies from.
Yeah, you think about it. Like, Jesus has just died. The Son of God has just died. And one of the first things that happens is that the temple, the curtain veil of the temple is torn in half. It's not needed anymore. It's not needed. The redemption's been accomplished. That's what the whole book of Hebrews is about. It's about the great high priest accomplishing redemption on our behalf. It's we can now see and dwell with God, not inside a temple, but on a mountainside and in prison. And, in the face of roaring lions in a Roman Colosseum that are about to devour Polycarp for his testifying in God, we can see the beauty of God everywhere because of Jesus. And so then after redemption, we have restoration. And this is when beauty is finally and fully restored at the second coming of Christ. At the end of Revelation, we have a garden city where the Son of God is going to be at the very center of both heaven and earth. There's not going to be need for the sun anymore because he's going to shine. That's Jesus displaying his beauty, not just to us, but to the entire cosmos. The Son is going to rule on the earth with his people. He reigns as king and is beheld by his people who will enjoy eternal delight in him. Okay? That is restoration. So that's beauty displayed in the meta-narrative. Okay? Creation, fall, redemption, restoration. There's a reason that we always talk about that in this class, and it's because it helps us understand any kind of theme that we talk about fits under that those categories, because those are the categories and the story of the cosmos. So that's God's outworking beauty in his glory throughout all of the new scriptures of the Bible. That's outworking beauty, okay? What about the inward beauty of God, okay? Let's consider God himself. The nature of God is beauty an attribute of God. Theologians actually debate this. It's crazy. They talk about, should we call it an attribute? I don't know. Remember earlier, we defined beauty as the transcendental quality of an object. But God is not an object, right? He's not a thing. He's not a place. He's a being. That's who God is ultimately. He's a being. And so what theologians and philosophers call a being is the study of the ontological. When Brad or myself or anybody says ontological, they're talking about the nature of being, right? They're saying that this has to do with God's nature himself. So if you remember when we talked about metaphysics, ontology is a branch of metaphysics, and it studies the science and nature of being. And so we turn to our philosophical neighbors and our friendly theologians in church history that help us understand these things, that help us understand ontology and metaphysics and being, to help give us a good sense of who God is in his beauty, in his ontological nature. Does that make sense? So we saw the outworking of it in the biblical narrative, and now we're getting a little bit more philosophical, a little bit more theological here. Okay? So consider Plato, all right? Plato, you remember, early classic ancient Greek philosopher. Plato's the one who comes up with the idea of forms, okay? And so Plato, of course, is going to say that beauty exists in the realm of the ideal. There's an ideal form of beauty. He's like, if you have this bottle of water, this is just a reflection, an image of the true form of the bottle of water that's existed in the realm of ideas. So for Plato, everything has an ideal form. There's an apple, and then there's a true apple, right? That's Plato. Then you have Aristotle, all right? He puts more meat on the bones of beauty. And Aristotle is going to say that beauty is found in both order and in symmetry, okay? So he's going to say that for something to be beautiful, there has to be straight lines connected on each side to it. There has to be some structure, some symmetrical structure to beauty. It has to be proportioned properly. There must be proportion to beauty. And so Thomas Aquinas, who was very much a disciple of Aristotle. Remember, Thomas Aquinas is in medieval theologians of the 1200s. He loves Aristotle. Augustine loves Plato. It's just the way it is. They're both disciples of these people. John Piper loves Jonathan Edwards. We're all standing on the shoulders of giants, right? But Aquinas is going to come along and say that there's three requirements for beauty. And for something to be beautiful, it must meet these three standard criteria. Firstly, it must have integrity or perfection. It must have a base, must have a perfected foundation. There must be integrity to it. Secondly, there must be due proportion or consonance. And thirdly, there must be clarity when things are brightly colored or called beautiful. So you have to be able, it must be clear, there must be proportion, and there must be perfect integrity. That's Aquinas, okay? And he's grabbing that from Aristotle, because Aristotle likes symmetry, okay? If we consider more of the ontology of God, theologian Jonathan King traces what he calls the beatitude of God. The beatitude of God. Beatitudes are often talked about in Jesus's the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall see mercy. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Those are beatitudes. He's drawing a connection of this is more of the beauty of God, the beatitude of God. And he defines the beatitude of God as the eternal condition in himself of absolute satisfaction and delight. Translation, God is a happy, eternal being. He's eternally happy. And that's bound up in our understanding of God's fullness of the Trinity. So we understand God not just as a single being, he is, but we also understand him to be eternally exist and expressed in three persons, as Brad talked about this morning, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So when the scriptures describe God as being beautiful in nature, this is often connected to his glory and majesty, because beauty is very, very hard to define, especially with an eternal being. And so there's language of majesty, glory, dominion, kingship that are connected to God's beauty. So let's look at the Bible here, because this is what's really going to define this for us. Psalm 27:4, one thing have I asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and also to inquire in his temple. Psalm 27:4. That's by the way, I think Psalm 27 is my favorite Psalm. Just trivial. Psalm 96:6, splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. You see this complementary language here. Splendor, majesty, strength, beauty. Psalm 145:5, on the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works, I will meditate. Zechariah 9:16, on that day, the Lord, their God, will save them as the flock of his people. For like the jewels of a crown, they shall shine on his land. For how great is his goodness, and how great is his beauty. Grain shall make the young men flourish, and new wine the young men, and new wine the young women. Job 40:10, adorn yourself with majesty and glory. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. So why is this significant that God is in and of himself beautiful? Okay. We talked about the reality that God is, if we're going to say that beauty is inherent to God's nature, which I think that these texts prove, then what's the point, right? What's the point of this? The point goes back to our conversation at the beginning of class about the subjective and the objectiveness of beauty, and why it's good that God designed a universe in which both are at play in our world, right? So truth is objective, goodness is objective, but beauty is distinct. The uniqueness of beauty, as opposed to goodness or truth, is that beauty evokes an emotional response out of us. In other words, we are what Augustine calls divine participants in God's beauty, right? We don't get to participate in truth. Truth is truth. Goodness is goodness. It's right or it's wrong. It's true or it's false. But beauty invites us in to who God is. This is something that is very, very key if we're going to understand the beauty of God. You think about God himself being the Trinity. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, they have perfect integrity with one another. They're perfectly symmetrical. meaning that their activities as Father, Son, and Spirit have a proper fittingness to it. There's fittingness to the mission of God in the Trinity. What does the Father do in the plan of redemption? The Father predestines and designs the plan before the foundation of the world, right? The Son accomplishes the plan. The Holy Spirit applies the work of redemption to our hearts. There's symmetry to God's beauty in redemption. And finally, the beauty of God is clear. It's very clear. Jesus is the critical lens for seeing God's beauty, because without him, we can't see God. Jesus said, I've come to reveal the Father to you, and if you don't know me, you don't know the Father. You think about, Brad talks about this all the time, in the J curve, right? The J curve, the descension and ascension of Christ. So this is essentially, this comes from Paul Miller, but it also comes from Philippians 2, is really where Paul Miller is getting it from. You think about the beauty of Jesus. Jesus didn't come in majestic glory or loud triumph. That's not how Jesus came to us. He came to us in humility, in a manger, outside of Bethlehem, with shepherds in an agrarian way. Listen to Philippians 2. It says, but he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Death, right? So he's humiliated himself. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed upon him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory, to the beauty of God the Father. That the whole way of beauty is down to up, descension to us, ascension. Because if he doesn't descend to us, if he doesn't become like us and take our place, we can't know him. But now, because he has done that, he's ascended higher above every name, above every deity of life or God or anything that we could possibly conceive of to worship. He's above it all. 2 Corinthians 4:6, God says, let light shine out of darkness, for he has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. I'll read it again. He says, let light shine out of darkness, creation. He's quoting Genesis. Has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That is the essence of beauty. Us getting to see the face of God through the person of Christ, what is more beautiful than that? So the primary way that we behold the beauty of God and not ourselves is by participating in that beauty. That beauty is going to arouse something out of us. That's it. We're going to respond to this. 2 Peter 1:3, this is what we're going to end on. Sorry, a lot of Bible. Not sorry, but this has to be one of the most mysterious and profound texts in all the Bible. His divine power, God's, has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who has called us to his own glory and excellence, okay? By which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, the promise of the gospel, the promise that he will dwell with us, the promise that he will be his God and we will be his people. These promises, okay, that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, that you may become partakers, participants in the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire. For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith, to not to add to your faith to get something extra, but to supplement to it, what? What does he say? Supplement your faith with virtue, truth, goodness, beauty, and virtue with knowledge. And knowledge goes to character, self-control. Self-control with steadfastness. Steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love. That's the whole point of what of why. That's the whole reason we're doing this class. We're not doing it for the sake of knowledge. We're doing it for the sake of becoming divine partakers with him, to supplement our faith with virtue. To supplement our faith that produces self-control and steadfastness and godliness, brotherly affection with one another. That's why we do these things. It's to see the beauty of God more clearly. And so that's the whole point of beauty in God's world. It's the objective marrying the subjective. And we see that God is the ideal of all that is beautiful in his nature. And then we get to participate in that divine nature by holding on to his promises and supplementing our faith in a world that includes truth, goodness, and beauty. So that's all I have today.